Hi, and welcome to Rule of Carnage. This is a series of podcasts, conversations, video blogs, whatever you want to call them, where myself, Glenn Ford, a game designer and developer, talks to this guy, Mike Hutchinson, also a games designer and developer. And what we do at length and for the ongoing foreseeable future is talk about designing better miniatures games. So we've been having various conversations sort of in our sort of outside of these conversations.
You think we don't prepare for these conversations, gentle listener. And
You couldn't
you'd be
tell
partially correct, but also we can't stop blabbing about it.
it. Yeah, we talk about the things we're going to talk about. We don't necessarily write things down and make notes, but we talk about it a lot. And what we've been talking about recently, amongst other things, is the difference or what we mean by simulation and emulation in relation to tabletop games.
And
And
this is a specific meaning which I caught from the lovely Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff podcast a while back, which is Robin DeLaw's RPG designer extraordinaire caught upon this usage of emulation, which he specifically meant to mean. Well, I've got the there's a definition of it in an article that they published on the Pelgrane Press thing. He meant it to compare between games that focus on simulation, resolve events as they would unfold in a causal reality, or games engage in emulation so that events unfold as they would in a movie or a book to keep the narrative running in a satisfying manner. And I suspect he had to invent this term after making Feng Shui in the or Feng Shui in the 90s, which was like a very much like a genre steeped Hong Kong action movie RPG where everything that he made, like all the design decisions in that were intended at least to be like movie logic first, to heck with like simulating normal reality.
well, I think because the thing is, so to my mind, simulation, I think strictly speaking, simulation is, recreating a thing via, different means, but the same sort of set of steps and events as would take place in the real thing. Whereas emulation is replacing those steps in order to recreate the effect, but not taking the same actual steps. So, for example, if I wanted to simulate hitting you with a baseball bat, I could hit you with a 2x4, a wooden 2x4. It wouldn't be the same thing, but I would simulate almost exactly the same result. If I wanted to emulate it, I could stick some electrodes in your brain, and I could cause you to have pain responses, and I could like go in surgically and alter your face so that it appears to have been bruised and battered, for example.
Yeah, I guess the problem is that trying to get to canonical definitions of these words is useless because like simulation and emulation in computer science mean something quite specific, and you emulate hardware by like literally reproducing the conditions on which it will be executed, which is actually way more like simulation in this meaning. But we don't mean it. We mean it in Robin DeLaw's, well, I mean it in Robin DeLaw's sort of movie logic sense of the word, which is we're emulating the tropes of a genre rather than simulating causal events. And to a degree, I think that the root of it here is important to me because Gygaxian role playing, to the best of my knowledge, having not played it in the 70s, but being aware of both, the original texts and the OSR, seems to be like you breathe life into a somewhat realistic fantasy world, and you let its clockwork operate, and through that you discover fun stories and magical things happen. But it has to tick like clockwork, otherwise you're cheating. And I think Feng Shui says bollocks to that. Let's cheat. Movies cheat. Stories cheat. Let's cheat because narrative's important, not like clockwork.
Yeah, I think the sort of for me the sort of analogy for simulation and emulation to me is a sort of possibly apocryphal story from the movie Marathon Man, where Dustin Hoffman, being a method actor, came on set and he was all sweaty and out of breath. And Sir Gielgud said, you know, oh, dear boy, what's wrong? He said, well, my character has been running a marathon. So I've been out running and I've been running and running, running, and he's all sweaty and exhausted. And Gielgud said, well, that's why we call it acting, you see. And that's a different, you know, Hoffman is simulating somebody who's been running, and Gielgud is going to would emulate somebody who'd been running by going, oh, I am very
tired. No, I think that's that works for me. That as a comparison, that definitely works. I think we're on the same page there.
But I think that in relation to game design, I really, when I think of these two things in games, I don't think either of those things particularly to them. What I think, you know, I think is close to your idea of it is that if I'm doing something that's emulating a moment, I'm hitting on these story beats and the emotional moments and the things that appear to be right to the feeling of it, as opposed to if I'm trying to simulate something, I'm trying to go through the steps of what are agreed sort of the processes of physics to do a given thing. So like, if something's happening that, you know, has a lot of emotional weight to it, in life we sometimes feel like things slow down and they get more detailed and we can sort of feel like more of the bits of what are happening, as opposed to when I'm making, you know, chicken parmigiano or whatever, and everything just blurs into one meaningless mass. And when I emulate that sensation in a game, you know, it's like, okay, well, these are the boring things. This is the making pasta part of the game. I'll put like maybe one, two resolution systems. Oh, and then this is the very exciting thing. This is the kissing the girl. This is the doing whatever. Let's put loads and loads of resolution systems here, because that's me emulating the feeling of life slowing down and speeding up and focusing and concentrating.
Yeah.
As opposed to if I was trying to do something simulationist, it's like, you get out the thing, you use the thing has a certain result, the person has a reaction to the thing, then the person gets out the thing. And it's like everything has the same rhythm and beats, you know, because this is what we perceive as like the reality of physics, cause and effect. For me, simulationism in a game is like everything needs to have one step and everything chains along and everything makes sense, and I don't put in more steps than it feels like the causal reality would have to have. So
and I suppose there's, and for me it bleeds somewhat fuzzily into the idea of like skipping out those steps or even making things happen that are illogical and that don't have a cause and effect. Like that for me, a lot of that is like the movie logic that I like to build into my sort of miniature game, so that there is like cinematic physics. So I'm trying to think of a good example from maybe A Billion Suns, but like, you know, there are things that I want to do, not because they make logical sense, but they're cool and they feel like the movies. And so as well as like you say, like dragging the camera focus in or out, you know, fast forwarding through boring sections because, you know, we don't need to see what the characters arriving at the airport. They arrive at the airport, here we are, that's what our resolution system decision making is doing. Like, you know, in X-Wing we don't have a big resolution system for how we get from the spaceship to the battle area. We just start deployed in the battle area. Like, that is the sort of basic camera pulling trick. But I think it's also the case that when I think about designing a game that's focused more on emulation than simulation, I think I'm also wrapped up in perhaps some baggage, which is saying I choose not to ascribe intrinsic value to making it realistic, even though I perceive that like it's possible to make it realistic or not realistic. I choose not realistic because it's more realistic to the, it's more evoking of the genre or whatever.
Yeah, and I think that sort of simulation, because nothing we're doing with these sorts of games on the tabletop can truly, I think, earn the name simulation. You know, it's always some version of emulation. Nothing I'm, you know, The sorts of tabletop games that are actual simulations are like, you know, dexterity games and things where you're actually, you know, playing golf by hitting something, you know, across the tabletop. Everything we're doing is some form of emulation. Rolling dice has nothing to do with hitting somebody with a sword and is no way a simulation of hitting somebody with a sword.
Right, but the obvious, sorry, no, carry on, finish your point, because I think you're
I
probably going to
just
make the same point.
I was just going to sort of say, but I think that simulation in these sorts of games is its own genre with it pers with its own tropes and its own steps. And I think it's interesting how often you can, like, if you play with that and you pull it around and you make it a bit more movie logical and a bit more emulationist, you will find players coming back with a sort of, but this isn't how things happen. This isn't how things should happen, because they're on this sort of, they're sort of more caught in the genre tropes of what has been represented as simulationism within particularly historical gaming, I think, personally.
So I guess the problem I've got with that, and it's not something I have a deep expertise in, so I'm sort of grasping here, but like, you know, I was talking about Harpoon, the early 80s naval game, which I kind of bumped into as part of doing my research for Pacific Command, but it, you know, is in and of itself fairly kind of infamous and noteworthy. And that is not an unplayably detailed game. Like it's not that one where you have a trillion tokens and it takes you 6 years to play 6 years of World War II. I forget what it's called right now. The campaign for West Africa, North
Oh,
Africa, or whatever. It's not that. It's much more sensible than that. But at its heart, it is rooted in the professional wargaming mindset of what we are here to do, ultimately, is a reflection of what professional wargaming is, which is, let's use the tools that we have in front of us to, as best as we can, sort of understand the enemy, predict our own tactics, strategy, success. And I've got this lovely book on my shelf here about it's called Winning in the Pacific, I think is what it's called. It's obscured right now, so I can't remember the title. And that's about what the US naval guys did to actually literally war game out on the tabletop ahead of some of the conflicts in World War II. And with that mindset, I think like the word simulation carries some significant meaning there, which is, you know, yes, we are abstracting. Of course, we're abstracting, but what we're trying to do is abstract to the point where, with the right inputs, we get a believable set of outputs, and those outputs are actually usable, you know, to make decisions that might affect real life. And the real life part of it gives it weight. But the project, the purpose of the project is to create a simulation that, at least at some level of abstraction, behaves like the real world. You give it inputs and it does real worldy type outputs. And perhaps if you run it n number of times, you get a statistically significant output and you're like, oh, okay, this is a better or a worse decision. And so I think for me, a lot of the baggage or the assumptions around the need to move away from movie logic and be realistic in the way that you produce your games is because of that. That's the echoes of that stuff that still, you know, still bounces around all of miniature games, all of war games on some level, because although we are, as you know, writers of fantasy miniature games, very far from that, we don't play those games, we don't read those games very often. Like we're all part of like a culture and a community of stuff that has that inside it. And, you know, lots of it comes from, anyway, I guess what I'm trying to say is I think I am to a degree a bit confused and mixed up in and need to pull apart my understanding of some of those sensations where it's like, I like what Robin D. Laws is trying to do by pulling away like games that are more met that are more like clockwork and more interested in causal reality as a way of creating ludic spaces, as opposed to simulation, because what I need is reliable inputs and outputs.
Well, and I think that's one of the things is that, you know, because you can have simulation of movie moments and you can have emulation of like historical reality. And I think that a game which is trying to let you war game out like reality in such a way that you could predict what is going to happen or recreate what did happen, we'll have to at some point put in emulational steps, just because, you know, people sat at a war game table, you know, don't have the emotional investment with what is happening, you know, to the troops that are being sacrificed, don't have the same sort of connection, the same sort of realities. And in order to have those realities within your simulation, you're going to have to emulate the fact that you are sending a human being to their death when you are not. You know what I mean? And I think those, and you need...
Okay, right. So because you're sort of saying, like, we didn't go through the motions enough to have method acting. What we need to do is just acting. Let's just pretend these guys are going to flee the battlefield at this point.
Yeah, or, you know, just, you know, it's like I can go through the statistics of, like, gun ranges and lethality, whatever, and I can sort of create that with dice so that a gun that is X percent lethal at X range in reality will be X percent lethal at the same scale range on my tabletop. I can simulate the effect of the gun being shot by a reasonably well-trained soldier at another soldier. What I cannot simulate is whether or not I'm willing to put a man in front of a bullet, you know, and whether I'm willing to accept a Pyrrhic victory, whether I'm willing to, you know, okay, this unit is unit, you know, pawn sacrifice. They're going to die horribly so that everybody else wins the battle. And it's like, those are things where a simulation doesn't necessarily recreate reality. And sometimes we want to put in rules saying, okay, even though you could totally sacrifice this person, you know, in order to win the battle, we're going to put in, like, victory points and things like that to say, you know, just like blowing up a baby isn't necessarily going to be a viable option to you just because it is a viable option to you. And so I think there are definitely moments where, in order to recreate reality, you have to engage in emulation, you know, more than simulation in these sorts of situations, because you've got to emulate the player not being a man sat at a table pushing around bits of plastic. You can simulate the relationship between the two bits of plastic to be the relationship between two people with rifles. You can't simulate me being a general putting men to their death.
Right. So to put it another way, we're sort of saying, like, we can build rules and mechanics and systems inside our games that, like a flight simulator, allows us to, like, if we hit the right speed, we achieve some lift, and if we steer the plane correctly, we can get off the runway. What we can't really do is then, inside that, like, video game or, you know, flight simulator sort of machinery, like, simulate the fact that, you know, you've got a crew of people behind you and you're about to crash, and what are you going to do in that situation? Like, on some level, there's things that we can connect with in a, I don't know if it's a logical or a cold way, but it's like, it's a systemic sort of clockworky nuts and bolts kind of a way. And there are things that just aren't available to, inverted commas, simulate in that way. And we have to rely on different strategies and techniques. And I suppose the only point of trying to make this distinction, other than, like, it's an interesting thing that, you know, I've been thinking about this thing from Robin D. Laws for a while now, I think it's important to figure out, like, I can sort of wave my hands and go, oh, it's movie logic. But I think I just find it important to figure out, like, what is the difference between my intention when I'm writing a system, writing a mechanic, writing a rule, and where am I okay with what feels like more cause and effect thing? Or when people look at a rule or they're playtesting something that I've written and are going, like, no, it doesn't feel realistic, it doesn't feel right. Like, this is just a diagnostic tool to be like, well, does it feel wrong because it's not meeting the genre tropes? Or does it feel wrong because, like, it's essentially a set of, like, understandable physical processes and you've guffed them up and they don't work. And now it's like, which is sort of like how collisions in Gaslands, like, people come at them the first time and go, well, the simulation of the physics is garbage. I hate collisions. And then you go, yeah, but think about Fast and the Furious. And they're like, Oh, okay, fine, I get it. And they kind of switch their mindset from simulation to emulation, and now they're cool. Now they're okay with the collision system.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that, like there where you're saying, oh, think of Fast and the Furious. Again, we come back so many times in these conversations. They're about setting player expectations and, setting out your stall and explaining what you're trying to do with your game. Because I more and more as I kind of I'm not that bothered about either simulating or emulating like physical reality. I'm interested in create, emulating feelings within a player. That's really what I'm trying to do. And it's like what you're saying there, where people say, oh, it doesn't feel realistic, it doesn't feel right. And I think those are two very different things. And it's like I unless I'm creating a specific sort of game that I haven't yet, wanted to try and create, I don't care if it feels realistic. I really care if it doesn't feel right, if it doesn't feel appropriate, if it doesn't match with the stall I set out. And if I'm going to design a game that is like, oh, super crunchy, realistic World War II simulator, and somebody says, oh, that didn't seem realistic. What that soldier did, that didn't seem realistic. That's a real problem. If I'm doing, whatever, my pulp pirate game, it's like, it's fine that it is not realistic. Jack Sparrow does not act in a realistic fashion.
No, in fact it's the opposite. It's like if it is realistic, it would be wrong.
Yes, it would be very problematic. Yes, if the pirates
Yeah, like if like Jack Sparrow just suffers like a crippling broken leg and there's like splintered bone everywhere, you're like, well, this is not the genre I was looking for.
this is not what I turned up for. Just for first time he lands off of her.
Swings over on the deck. It's like lands slightly wrong, snap.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm trying to do a thing. I'm trying to make you feel like you're in a Pirates of the Caribbean movie. So, really, realism is of no concern to me.
Yeah, and I think probably for this podcast, we're probably preaching to the converted, but like I think as I grew up as a games designer in the 90s, like that was not clear from the games that I was reading. There was seems to me a very intrinsic push that was like, no, simulating is correct, not simulating is incorrect. And I think that like probably the reason that Robin D. Laws invented this term is because he was fighting against that current status quo and people being like, yeah, I mean, so I think, I think we're well beyond that point, but at the same time, I feel like that's important, and so I just wanted to st stick a nice magic marker pen around that.
No, absolutely. And I think one of the nature of a game that is about people, figures moving through space and interacting with each other is that the one genre that everybody has experience of is reality. Everybody knows what it is like to walk across a street and go through a door, and everybody knows how fast, the average person can run and what it would be like to dive through a window, maybe.
Right, but none of that has anything to do with Jason Bourne movies, like none of that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so and again, it's like sort of trying to go back to sort of saying, okay, look, I know that this isn't how people climb up the side of buildings. I know that this is not how the average person jumps from one rooftop to another, but we are not being average people today. We are being cyberpunk, boosted up warriors. We are being Jason Bourne. We are being whatever we are being. And let's all come together and say, okay, these are the new realities. If I deviate from those, you're legit in like piling on me. But if what I'm doing is, if what you're being is like, oh, what the hell, you'd never reload your gun. Well, of course I never reload my gun. It's an American action film from the 90s. No one
Yeah.
reloads their gun,
This conversation makes me curious about how often my imagination goes back to the Xbox game Crackdown for no good reason. Like, it's probably like, I don't know, it's probably like actually a terrible game when you compare it to lots of other things. But like, just what you're saying there, like the willful disregard that that game had for like how far you could jump, and the fact that the more you jumped, the more you could jump. And at one point, you know, after jumping quite a lot, you can just jump up an entire like 6-story building. And like it just sets the expectation of that quite early on, and then just wraps it in a lot of nonsense. So you're like, at no point are you analyzing the fact that, you know, your dude can jump 6 floors up. You're just like, woohoo.
Well, yeah, and it's like one of my favorite series of other videos is a guy who, you know, takes games and then does a thing that shouldn't work but does work in order to point out how stupid the game is. You know, it's like a falling from a 6-story building in order to get better at jumping because it works, you know.
Yeah.
And yeah, and I think a lot of games. Yeah, you have to sort of set out your stall. You have to say, look, this is the reality we're living in. Nothing, I think, on the tabletop is strictly, you know, c can sort of say it is a true simulation. Everything is trying to achieve a given goal. And that goal might be to get you to act the way that a platoon commander in World War II acts. It might
Yeah.
be trying to get you to act the way that Jason Bourne acts. It might be getting into act the way that Jack Sparrow acts. They are all choices in emulating, you know, a reality on the tabletop. And that choice can be somewhere on the pole from what would be simulation if we could simulate things through to, you know, emulation, which is kind of what they all are. But it's all just choices about what you're trying to recreate, what you're trying to give your players as an experience, and what your stall is that you're setting out for the world in which your game exists.
All right.
Okay, I think that's an acceptable examination of simulation and
Yeah.
emulation.
That seems like a good place to take a quick break.
Quite a lot of games that I would think of as simulation games are quite detailed, and they achieve simulation by having quite a lot of detailed mechanics and quite a lot of things that you might think of as movie magic, like things that are sort of going for genre tropes, can, particularly more recently, be quite sort of impressionistic and abstract in their mechanics. But as Glenn's grimacing is amply demonstrating for the viewer on YouTube, they're not really at all related, and you can have extremely detailed emulation. My mind turns to the Realm of Chaos tables that Glenn and I were stumbling through some months ago. But you can also have, you know, very effective simulation based on quite abstracted mechanics. In fact, you have to, and even very detailed realistic games, if I might say so, like Harpoon, obviously, you know, ignore and abstract vast quantities of real information and battlefield activity and what, you know, thousands of individual humans are up to on various battleships in modern naval engagements, because they have to, because there's not time to manage all that stuff. So I guess I just wanted to, yes, sorry, Glenn's, go ahead, man.
Well, okay, look, for me, it's not that simulations are inherently more detailed than sort of more movie logic games.
No,
It's
yeah, I agree.
about what it is that they tend to expend their detail upon. So, you know, as I was saying in the last conversation, if you're doing like a movie logic game, like, okay, you know, we've got two gunslingers in the Old West, and they're drawing their gun, and it's like walking out to the gun shoot, gunfighting area. Who cares, you know, etc. This, I don't care, don't care, don't care, don't care. Now they're starting to go for their gun, and do, 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 and time slows right down, and we've got a resolution system for the finger twitching near the trigger. We've got a resolution system for where their eyes are looking. We've got a resolution system for the beads of sweat coming down their forehead. Extremely movie logical, incredibly detailed.
Can be, yeah, exactly.
Whereas I think sometimes for realistic games, simulationist games, it's like every bit of minutiae gets equal weighting for its detailing. It's like tracking the ammo on a gun that you don't really care about. It's like ninth gun, it never does anything, but you still got to track the ammo and the heat on the weapon and all these sorts of things. I think that sort of detailing is what makes something feel like it is within the genre of reality, because it's like, I don't care, I don't need to care, but the fact that I'm tracking it, oh, that must be like verisimilitude, because who cares about tracking these things? Whereas, yeah, no, I totally think that like simulation can have swathes of abstraction. Look, it's like, you know, in reality, if we count up the number of like men and the tech level of their weapons and the place they're fighting, we don't need to play the game because we have history that will tell us who will win that battle. And the best possible simulation is just to calculate who's there, look at, you know, historical reality and go, well, that side's going to win. It's obviously going to win. It's got way more guns and men and et cetera, et cetera. You know, bothering to see if the underdog... No, the underdog loses. the underdog loses is reality. You know, we may as well abstract the whole game,
yeah, find
out who's the underdog and skip it, you know, for true simulation.
No, right. And so I think that, like, for me that it's super tempting to equate these two things together. And you're exactly right that, like, where you put the detail draws the attention of the players, and where you draw the attention of the players is where your game is actually happening, and that's what the game is about. And so it's easy to say, well, this game is like comparatively between games, it's easy to say, well, this one is more detailed, it's more finicky, it's got more bits and bobs, it's got more rules to learn. This one is more abstract, it's simpler. And that is important for players to understand. And, you know, as players, we maybe prefer an amount of detail, or, you know, on one end of the spectrum or another. I think what's more interesting is, as you suggest, like inside a game, where is the relative levels of detail inside the game? Where have you applied detail to the mechanics? And as you say, and I hadn't really thought of it in those terms, like whether you apply that detail strategically, specifically with, like, you know, with the filmmaker's eye, or whether you are just saying, well, this is a detailed game, ergo I shall put detail anywhere. But to call back to sort of Gygax, slash OSR type role-playing systems from the last conversation, there is sort of like, there is a hope, I think, in an alternative form of gaming where by simulating everything to a degree, like equally, you allow the sort of clockwork reality to bubble out things that are interesting, as opposed to a world where you have very much designed, like, well, I'm going to put a lot of detail into the sweat dripping down the cowboy's face mechanic and not very much detail into the which ammo did they choose and which shop did they buy the ammo from. And so you're very much, like, as an auteur, you're very much saying, well, here is where I choose the narrative interest to come from. Whereas to a degree, the OSR is saying, no, let us create a real feeling world, and the world and the people's actions within the world will tell us what's interesting, and so we don't need to select, which of course is nonsense, because you also have like very deliberate design decisions about, well, I'm going to track torches, but I'm not going to track the thinness of my boot leather for the adventurer's boots.
It's like, you know, whatever this cinema verite thing of like, well, yeah, but you're still deciding where you point the camera. You've done something here. And it's like there's a bit of a legendary terrible Kickstarter called Galactica Magnifica, and one of the things that this Kickstarter is doing, along with claiming to build literal spaceships to, you know, go out to other solar systems, is that it's going to make a 1-for-1 scale and timeline simulation of the entire Milky Way and all its inhabitants, so that you can play this computer game with this game, and it will take everything will take the exact same amount of time that it would do in real life. So you're going to go to the airport in order to fly to Mars, and you're going to get stuck in traffic, and it will take you as long as it would take you getting stuck in traffic, and et cetera, et cetera. And it's like, obviously that's insane and terrible. That's obviously a terrible, terrible, terrible game, because it's also not set in the future when he's making it. It's set today. So what you would get to play is this. You would just be playing this, and it would be awful.
Mm-hmm.
And it is like, I think this is one of the reasons that it's like, the simulation and reality games are still a genre, because part of that sort of being interested in the minutiae is saying, no, the point is that in this like genre, you don't get to skip to the good bit. Just like in life, you don't get to skip to the good bit. You go don't get to ignore things that don't matter. You don't, you know, you don't get to not have to sit in traffic. You don't have to, you know, never have to go to the toilet, because we are living in this certain sort of genre, and this sort of certain sort of genre is everything is as important as everything else. You know, everything is worth paying attention to, and so we're going to pay attention to everything. And so the emotional effect of the player of them being able to go, oh wow, this is just like reality, this is just like life, isn't it amazing that I'm experiencing the reality of what it is like to be a soldier in World War II, a commander in the Pacific, a what that I love feeling like I'm actually experiencing that. But of course you're not anything close to it, but because we've not allowed you to decide what is important and what to focus on, or we've decided for you, or we've stepped in as an auteur and
exactly like in order to give that experience to the player of what it might have been like to, like, you know, make decisions as a commander in the Pacific Theater, like you have to provide the decisions that are interesting in that and ignore the decisions that aren't interesting. Like whether or not you take sugar in your coffee is not relevant and interesting. It's not, you know, it wouldn't be featured in the textbook. It wouldn't be in the movie. And so it's not in the game either. And so as game makers with a sort of continuing this kind of filmmaking borrowing of terms, like, you know, we've got to focus, we've got to choose where we point the camera, we've got to focus on the things that matter. And I think that where we put mechanics is our camera.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things about us being, well, I mean, I think more maybe gamic, filmic style sort of auteur game designers is that we have the armor of like, well, suspension of disbelief. Okay, it doesn't make any sense, it's unrealistic, I don't care, I am making a game, suspension of disbelief, get over it, move on. If you're making like a full-on simulation-y simulation that's meant to be super realistic, as soon as somebody says,
you shouldn't listen to this podcast, we don't know anything about it.
Oh yeah, no, you know, we are not the people to ask. But you know, part of that is almost like I wouldn't say afraid of, but the fact that, you know, not having that armor, it's very sort of exposing, I think, for those sorts of games. Because, you know, as soon as somebody says, well, that's not realistic, I should have had to track the ammo on my blah, blah, you know, remember that battle where that thing ran out and 1,000 men died. And you're like, yeah, I didn't create all of reality within this game. I am at fault. I have no shield for it. You know, it's like, it's lovely being able to say, yeah, I didn't simulate that because I don't care, because my game doesn't care. And if you did care about that, maybe I'm wrong in having like led you down the wrong path, but that's just not what the game's about. It's not what this game's about. Suck it. Whereas if you're making a game about reality, everybody is right when they come at you with those things. Everybody is correct. Every single thing you left out that they missed should have been in. And that's a really frightening prospect as a game designer, you know, where not being able to say like, yeah, whimsy and magic and baloney is the reason I did it. You know, whereas, yeah, having to.
And say, I think the idea of this dramatic focus for me, like I've said it already in this conversation, but it does feel very local and specific to a game. Like, I don't think we're saying you should make more detailed mechanics in the places that are important to your game, and you should hear that as a specific level of detail, because we don't have an empirical level of detail that's relevant for that comment. It's just like, if you're going to make any rules, that's going to be where the player's attention and their gaze is drawn, and quite often you'll just want some other things to just be completely automatic or completely irrelevant. And yeah, making those decisions, I think, is mostly instinctual for most of us. And I think to a degree, it's like, it's fairly instinctual because we're playing in a relatively limited set of, like, well, it's mostly shooting each other and axing each other in the face type of games. And so we've kind of got a fairly standard set of like what we care about. And it's why I haven't finished editing the video for it yet, but like your game Borders and Black Flags, which says we're not going to punch each other in the face, we're going to sort of swing you bodily into the path of a moving crate so that you get knocked off the boat or squashed by it or whatever. Like, the reason that feels so strange is that it bucks the conventions of where we think the mechanics should be. And so I guess to a degree, this is a bit like coming back to that conversation that says, should I always put rules for knifing each other? And the way that I think I can now express that was, well, would you point your camera at the knifing of people? Or is that something that you would have off shot, off camera, as a like as an event that happens because it triggers the thing that you're actually interested in, which is the subject of your creation?
Yeah. And I suppose like one of the reasons that this is possibly like a little tricky to sort of, I know, explain, teach, whatever it is that we do here, is that it's a level about
masticate, like, is what we do.
Is that I think to a degree it's like it's about sort of personal, it's about confidence, it's about sort of having the confidence in your design and the sorts of things you are confident in. Because like I say, I don't want to do a simulationist game because I don't feel like I would have the armor of saying this is what I care about. But then for a certain sort of person, a certain sort of designer, being able to say, well, this is what I care about, and using that as armor is harder than just than going like, no, I'm trying to craft and create all these sorts of different things at once and in reality. And I tell you, again, you know, the things that come up again and again on the channel is like knowing your game and knowing what it cares about and having like a strong early sort of design document brief and setting down what it's about and coming back to those touchstones and going, oh yeah, this is what my game cares about. This is what I said I cared about. This is what I said I was trying to do. Let's not be, because it's so sort of seductive to put in an extra rule for this thing that will sometimes be cool and sometimes be interesting. And some people want in there because it is a reality or a thing that's happening. So why is it occurring on the tabletop? And, you know, it's so important to go back again and again and again to those things and go, no, I just can't care about everything. I can't.
Yeah. And thinking about your ludicrous example of the Kickstarter, like, and framing it in kind of video game terms, like it's sort of like saying, well, you know, you have a kind of game that you want to make and you have a kind of story that you want to tell and you have lots of ideas for other features that you could put in your game, but each of those features needs implementing in your rules code, and therefore every one of those features that you add, like, it creates the possibility of bugs and you know, and like inadvertently ruining the player experience because they're focusing on a slightly less polished part of your thing because you thought, oh, it would be cool to have like a boarding system, even though it's not really important to have a boarding system, but like I didn't spend as much time and now there's kind of crumminess in that mechanic. So yeah, like that design document and that objectives sort of giving you focus and then having the confidence to resist not only your own ideas, but also what your playtesters and the people around you are saying would be cool, and saying, yeah, but that's just more bloat. It's more features that I don't need. It's more bugs that I'm going to introduce. It's more stuff that I have to balance. It's more distraction for the player that's pulling them away from the core point and the sort of core story of the game.
Yeah, and I think we say sort of, you know, it's one of the things I end up finding myself returning to quite often is that there are 100 great versions of any given game that are your version of your game, you know, and like...
Do you ever feel sad about that?
No, me personally, no.
I'm quite sad about it because like I really like A Billion Suns and there's another Billion Suns that I'm sort of sorrowful for.
I don't know, I think... Funnily enough, this is maybe a sort of a side conversation, given that one of my intro into this world of designing and putting games out there was spending a lot of time defending your decisions to other people about Gaslands.
Yeah.
And so I feel like I got quite grounded in this thing of saying, yes, there's tons of good versions of this thing that isn't this thing,
right?
This version of it, but screw it, this is the version of it, and this is why it was done, and therefore that is the thing I'm going to go to bat for, because that's what I'm doing now, and so I'm going to go to bat for it, even if, and sometimes I've been in conversations defending things that I told you you shouldn't do that you still did to other people, saying it was the right decision, because that's what it is now, because
yeah.
And I've said a few times, what I try to do now in our relationship is advocate for something and then walk away from it. And
right.
You know, and if it's your game and you make the decision, it's like either version was right. Very often either version was right in design, but it's like, this is a thing and this is what that thing means. And that could be interesting for these reasons, but it doesn't need to be in there because nothing needs to be in there.
Yeah. And so I think like just looping back right around to the beginning of this conversation, like, There are mechanics that you want to abstract, and there are mechanics that you want to build detail into. And I think what I am quite confident now, and I think you invented this term dramatic focus, which has just clicked so much for me, because it's about where do you want the drama and the narrative to emerge from, and it feels like a camera pointed at things. And so I really like this idea that where you choose to put the more detailed mechanics is where you direct the player's attention, and therefore it's what the dramatic focus of your game is. And whether that is a realistic simulation game or a highfalutin fantasy shoot 'em out, it doesn't matter. The mechanics and the detail equates to the narrative, to the dramatic focus.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Rules are where your player's going to be looking. And so the longer you want them to look at something, the more rules you put in there and the more detailed you make them. It's how you manipulate them. It's how you get, them where you want.
Yeah, and also, like, if you put that at the center of the spider's web, so lots of other things connect to it, that's also another way of building complexity. But yeah.
And with that, we'll take a quick break.
And one of the things about attracting people to the genre tropes of your game is that you want them to enjoy what it is like to be a ... Oh, this is just what it's like to be a pirate swashbuckling and jumping about. Oh, this is what it's like to be a mad, like, wastelander in my car smashing people to oblivion. That sort of enjoyment is what we are, you know, rightly or wrongly, going to term diegetic enjoyment in this conversation. It is enjoyment within the world of your game, the reality of your game. At the same time, as you're playing your game, you're going to be going, like, at times, hopefully, if things have been done well, well, that's a really clever mechanic. It was elegant. I like how it sort of covered a lot of things with a single rule that was smart, and you had to learn one thing, and it did like 10 things. Or like, I rolled a 6. Yay! 6 is cool. Or I won this game. These are all examples of non-diegetic enjoyment. They are fun that does not exist in the game world, but comes like from the game for the players. Obviously, you want your game to be fun, like mm-hmm. to a certain given value of fun, engaged, whatever you want to call it. So, like, figuring out how much juice we can squeeze through these two forms of enjoyment in and out of the game world, around the game, making sure that one of them doesn't, you know, get in the way of the other one, is probably quite important for designing your games. So we're going to have a conversation about it.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, like, one of the things that I was trying to wrestle with, you know, I'll be completely honest, because, like, you know, I have to explain my decision of quitting my job to go and make miniature games to a number of people in my life. And they know that I love miniature games, but it has raised the question of, like, why do I love miniature games so much? And also, I don't necessarily design other kinds of games. Like, I don't design board games and card games at the moment. Maybe I will in the future. But there's something about the miniature world, the little world in front of me, that is particularly interesting. And the gentle viewer might have seen my somewhat ludicrous experiment with a chess sort of Well, basically, you and I were having a conversation about 6 weeks ago, six episodes back, where chess but with list building was mentioned, and that caught my imagination, and some terrible things happened as a result. So anyway, the idea of Chess 28, which is like, what if chess was miniature agnostic, really cuts to this difference between, like, why does chess but it's miniature agnostic make me really excited, whereas chess just makes me really cross and, like, bored at the same time. I don't know what that emotional state is, but like, it's real, and I have
I'm
it.
I'm sure the Germans have a word for it.
And you know, I don't mind abstract board games, but I don't choose to play them anything like as much as themey board games. And we talk like, you know, in the board game world, we talk a lot about theme and whether the abstraction of the game is at all related to the theme, or if it's just pasted over the top of an abstract set of mechanics. But I think in miniature games, we are very much more programmed to, or we very much more expect to create mechanics that map quite cleanly onto like the theme. And so we're creating mechanics which are about like this Space Marine being able to shoot this gun at that guy through this piece of terrain. And I think that's partly the historical roots of it. But I think it's also because our little figures are quite specific and physical. And so the idea of taking a very abstracted mechanic and then trying to place it on top of miniatures, like you would with a board game, kind of confuses people. And, you know, I've had this criticism comment on A Billion Suns. They're like, well, it's just a board game, but you happen to play it with miniatures. And I think that all of this is sort of like rattling around my head, trying to figure out what is it that I love about having theme. And we know we've talked about that word being inaccurate, but what is it about having this kind of game world animated in front of me that doesn't happen in chess and that doesn't happen in abstract board games, but does happen in video games and does happen in the best miniature games? And so I think it's absolutely this what, you know, we were struggling for a word, and we were chatting about film terminology and diegetic music. If you haven't encountered it in film studies, is, you know, when there is music that's inside the world of the film. So, you know, the Star Wars Cantina Band is diegetic music. The opening theme as the credits roll is non-diegetic music. It's not heard by the characters. It doesn't exist inside the world. And I think there's a lot of stuff that we choose to put into games, or that we choose to put mechanics around, or that we extract enjoyment from, which are because they're happening in the game world. And quite often, I think there's a, you know, we spent a bunch of time talking previously about the distinction between like competitive versus narrative. And I think maybe a much more helpful way of talking about that is like, there are players who are looking for more diegetic enjoyment from the games. They want the game to speak to them in game world terms, and they want to get more juice from squeezing the game, which tastes like having fun in that world. Whereas there are some players who, you know, if the world doesn't isn't particularly attractive to them, or it's not generating very much interest on the table, they're fine as long as there's mechanical interest, there's logical puzzles, there's good game design to interact with. I've used the word game design there, but I don't like to use the word games design there, because I think games design is both of these things. But like, there's non-diegetic enjoyment to be had from. And this is where chess comes in. It's like, chess is, you know, infinitely interesting to the certain kind of person, because it's got all of this completely meta sort of nothing to do with the world of the little, you know, armies go battling on the chess field. But lots of people get a ton of non-diegetic enjoyment from that. And I don't think I'm a competitive player or a narrative player. I think I'm a person who appreciates a really nice mix of, you know, non-diegetic enjoyment from crunchy good mechanics that work elegantly, that also link into the game world and inspire this, you know, imagination sort of, you know, it summons up imaginings of what's going on, and it represents what's going in the game world really well, and it gets my imagination firing. And I think the reason I want to give these two things terms is because I quite often, when I'm working on a design, I don't necessarily haven't really had any way of conceptually separating those things. And I definitely feel that like, it's narrative versus competitive. It just, it doesn't work for me. And it's not because I feel angry about that definition. It's just like, it doesn't work for me. It's logically inaccurate.
I think that like, you know, say sort of, okay, non-diegetic enjoyment is or look at this mechanic, or I have won the game.
Mm.
But, you know, also non-diegetic enjoyment is, ha ha ha, Mike wasn't expecting me to do that. Look at his face now that I have.
Yeah. The social stuff, absolutely.
You know,
100%.
Social gaming, you know, the social part of gaming is non-diegetic enjoyment, which, you know, I think is a sort of very central part to sort of.
Deduction games. Some social deduction games are very non-diegetic in that they are about fooling each other because of language, and some have an element of role-playing in, and therefore like have a game world that you step into, which is fun, as well as having the non-diegetic sort of, you know, puzzle, you know, social deduction stuff in.
Yeah, and I think, like, you know, a minute ago you were saying, like, you know, you play like fewer board games. I know that you like A Fake Artist Goes to New York, which is a game sort of so barely with a theme to it that I don't even know who the fake artist is and why they're going to New York, and why when they go to New York they have to construct a picture out of random lines.
But I always introduce the game with that conceit and someone around the table, like, you know, often I've played it with 8 or 10 people, and a couple of those people, the conceit matters, and that like provides for them of a source of diegetic enjoyment where they're like, oh, I'm pretending to be an artist in New York. Oh, well, this is suddenly interesting. Whereas the other 8 people will just be like, so it's just Pictionary, right?
But I think, you know, the point I was sort of going to there is that the thing about Fake Artist Goes to New York is it's a really small game. It's really short. An atom of play is very small. It's physically sort of tiny. And a lot of board games are sort of conceptually, physically, engagement-wise, smaller than Minis games. The sort of Minis games we talk about are what some people refer to as like lifestyle games. You know, you have to acquire the Minis, you have to paint the Minis, you have to like learn a whole bunch of rules. And sometimes, because I think you're right in that the idea of one of these games with no diegetic element to it whatsoever is weird. It's weird. I really struggle.
Yeah, no, I can imagine playing something that resembles 40K, but with like various colored wooden blocks on like an abstract wooden block table. But like even at that point, I would translate it into that scene in Control where you have like an abstract combat zone, or that thing in Assassin's Creed 2 where you have an abstract combat zone. Like, yeah, I would still just be tempted to lay a diegetic enjoyment across the top of it.
As soon as you're saying like, okay, well, I've been playing 40K with just blocks and markers. Right. And would that block and marker be shooting that other block and marker? Would the other block and marker then die if it did? It's like,
it would have to interact at range and cause it to non-exist.
I mean, is range the right word in that point? Is it a ranged interaction when you're not actually
it makes a vector interaction.
You perform, and because this is one of the things, because in a separate sort of conversation we've been talking about the nature of like conceits within games, that like I'm shooting you. Well, I'm not shooting you, but it's the conceit of the game is that I am shooting you. And when you try and talk about these sorts of games without any of that language, it's impossible. It's impossible to explain what the hell is going on in one of these games without any use of any of that sort of terminology, only referring to the like mechanical realities of the game is just
right. Whereas exactly as you point out in Fake Artist in New York, we simply have to explain what we're doing, which is you have to draw one line, continuous line, and then pass the piece of paper on.
Yeah,
and there doesn't have to be any wrapping of the game world story about it. We left the story at the opening description of the game. It was irrelevant then. It remains irrelevant throughout the entire game.
Yeah, and it's like a lot of board games, I think, obviously abstract board games, like fully abstract board games, you know, we don't need the sort of the conceit language in order to explain what is going on when you're like laying down tiles in Ingenious or something. And a lot of the sort of hardcore Euros, or you know, what we call Euros generally, you don't really need the theme. I don't super need the theme to play Viticulture. I could totally get through that without you ever referring to any of these things as grapes or wine or a maturing room. You could say, move that block to there, it has to stay there for that amount of time, this card is worth that many points, etc. But when we get to these sorts of miniatures games, there's like so many moving parts, and the way that those moving parts relate to each other are so intrinsically to do with these sort of, you know, these in-world explanations, that I feel like the diegetic nature of these games is like an emergent property, like consciousness within the human mind. It's like, I don't think you could do this without it just popping out some diegetic moments of saying, oh, that guy runs fast, that's why he gets to move. And then it's like, okay, we're doing it now,
right? And so here I think is where we reach something that's been bothering me for a while, which is like one thing that, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but one thing that you kind of talked about a few times before on this channel, which I've nodded along to and I like 80% agree with, is like, if you don't use the miniature, like, why are you creating one of these games? Like, if the miniature itself isn't doing a thing mechanically, like, it could just be a disc. Why isn't it a disc? Like, what are we doing here? And if you've got a disc, why can't we have squares? And why aren't we just making a board game? And I follow all of that up to a point, but I think this concept gives me another route into something, which is the use of miniatures, painted miniatures, lovingly constructed miniatures, you know, terrain, arranged in such a way that I'm not constrained by discrete squares, like on a board. It gives me access to this imagination triggering game world that, as I've been working on this Chess 28 game, like putting these figures on that are like, well, the figures that I choose in the collection that I choose, and the terrain is the terrain that I've selected, like it just evokes and triggers my imagination in a way that compellingly justifies the existence of the miniatures beyond their function non-diegetically, if that makes any sense. Like, they don't need to function as miniatures to serve a function in the game design, which is to trigger my imagination and therefore my enjoyment, and I'm having more fun because there are miniatures.
I'm saying that, you know, the game has miniatures in it. I'm not necessarily coming to the game or the design for the miniatures, but I understand the miniatures have a purpose, and it's good that the miniatures are in the game. And probably if the miniatures weren't in that game, I would say I'd rather play one with miniatures in it. But they're still not sort of necessarily why I'm at the design, in front of the design in that sort of world. I'm there because I'm interested in what the game is going to do. I own a considerable number of miniatures, you know, anyway. I don't need a game to be bringing to me the idea of more miniatures in my life. I don't need more miniatures in my life by any stretch of the imagination, you know. That if a game can be like, okay, just use whatever minis you happen to have around. And this is one of the things about miniatures agnosticism that I like, that there are games that sort of go, use the miniatures you've already got. Let's just chill out about the miniatures, guys. Let's relax about what they are. Let's play this
game. Right, and I think that like, you know, mantra of this channel, that absolutely just goes down to what your objectives for a particular game or a particular design or as a designer are. Because I think that, yeah, in many cases, like, I might create games, not in many cases, there are some cases where I might create games specifically, you know, with this idea that, well, I don't necessarily want to inspire you to create miniatures, or I don't care for you to create miniatures. Take Pacific Command, for example. I am very excited about the non-diegetic sort of components of that. Although I am very excited about the in-world sort of, a lot of it's very diegetic. It just doesn't have miniatures in it. But in this case, like, maybe that's just the difference between our styles and our tendency towards setting goals for ourselves, which is, I am excited to be set hobby challenges, and therefore I will set other people hobby challenges. You are less excited to receive hobby challenges, so you are less excited to give them as a designer to others.
I suppose in reality, for me, it's this sort of thing. Okay, so I mean, Puke Apocalypse is a really sort of good example. It has hobby literally baked into the rules. It literally forces you to do hobby as part of the rules. And so obviously, you know, I'm giving people, you know, hobby challenges, but that's because I'm like, I want to give you something for doing your hobby, and I want to enter you back into that loop. And I want all of this to be a sort of a holistic experience. All the things you are doing about this game feed into the other bits of the game. And I'm not going to go, here's the game and here's some hobby, because if I'm going to do that, that's the thing I don't need. And you can have it or not have it. What I want is to do that. And I want to go like, they're really part of each other, and they really care about each other, and they really feed into each other. And in a way, it's like, that's not my sort of not caring about the hobby and making miniatures and painting miniatures and all sorts of those sorts of things. I do that because I care about it, because I want to give it extra value, and I want it to be intrinsic to the game, and I want to say like, it really matters for this game. That's how much I care about it. You can't play this game without doing hobby. That's how much I'm going to make you do hobby.
Yeah, and I also fundamentally think that it's your particular artistic expression of that, and that's what's so good about it, is that there's no correct way to approach this part. It's simply, what is the offer you wish to put in front of your players? And some players will take certain offers and some players won't take other offers, and some people will be motivated by some things and some people will look for other motivations. You know, so one player will come to that and go, amazing, I'm being invited to do a hobby, and everything that I do in regards to that is linked into the game and it matters and it's meaningful. And another player will come in and go, well, I'm being constrained and I've got this slightly different idea that doesn't quite fit and it's not being permitted and I'm annoyed by that. And you can't please all the people all the time, and you need to be focused about what your design is. And in this case, you've been very focused about it. I think what to sort of go back a few paragraphs, like why I'm excited about this idea of understanding for the first time for myself something like some conceptual wrapper for why miniatures might matter in creating and evoking fun in other players, is that it gives me a way of not making an excuse for, like, just conceptualizing why I am excited by doing something different to what you've described there. And I think that you've ended up putting a very nice relationship between the game world and the rules world, and that's very tightly mixed together. And there are some other games which separate those two things much more. They make those things much more incidental to each other. It's nice to have hobby. It's nice to have game. They will bump into each other on the table, but they're not, you know, to a degree, Hobgoblin is very much like this. Hobgoblin has placed those things in proximity to each other, but not really wired them together in any meaningful way deliberately.
I mean, yeah, I mean, Hobgoblin has done it to a degree that's almost avant-garde in a way, because it's like, I mean, you know, components like teach rules, and the great sort of value in many ways of miniatures for like teaching people rules and helping people through the game is, which of these is more powerful than the other?
Yeah, this, you can read more, it across the table. Yeah.
This is more powerful, important than this. I don't need to teach you any rules. I need to show you these two things, and you instantly know who is important, who matters, who's vital for the game. In Hobgoblin, no, not particularly. Not in any particular way, not necessarily.
You'll have
this
to ask.
This guy could be like way more important and powerful than this guy, which is insane. In its own way, an insane choice to make, to go like, you know how much like miniatures instantly teach rules and position and relationship between two forces and progress within the game?
But the difference, so I think what is missing from that description is that I wrote that with an assumption that the context is that you play miniature games. Like, I don't imagine Hobgoblin to be anyone's first miniature games. It might be someone's first rank and flank game, but I don't think that necessarily counts in the same way. So, like, I'm not having to teach people to read the basic sort of lay of the land of how these games function. I'm offering, like, a particular niche experience, which I think is exciting and missing. And so, yes, components teach rules, but also, like, you bring a bunch of baggage in with you.
And this is the thing, it's like, within the world in which, you know, I've played X many years of Warhammer Fantasy Battle, Hobgoblin slots in and it's very comfortable and it does some interesting, exciting mechanical things, but a lot of the stuff just makes sense within that world. And without that world, it's a fucking art piece.
Maybe.
It's borderline surreal if you don't come from that world and you're just like, anything can be anything all of the time. Gee, you have blown my mind, sir. You
know? Well, I love that other people have started like going, all right, I've got some like barbarian berserkers, but I'm going to call them a chariot because that like has the right rules description. I'm like, yes, that's exactly what you're supposed to do. And you're absolutely right. Like at that point, people are like, what? So these berserkers have two wheels and are pulled by horses? No, not relevant. Like unplug that part of your brain.
And it's
which is oddly extremely non-diegetic approach to it. It's like, well, what's the most rules appropriate way of describing this unit so I can get the most evocative flavor from this unit and it behaves exactly as it's supposed to and the fiction it tells itself on the battlefield.
Yeah, no, and it's
sorry, maybe I've gone the other way around and I've connected theme and mechanics like arse about face.
Well, in a way, it's an oddly meta game sometimes. It's been really fascinating in the Discord seeing different people coming to it and people butting up against, okay, so this word means X, and what I mean by that word is X, so why isn't it doing X? It's like that word's just a word. It's just a label that's just been pinned onto a rule. I don't care.
Mike needed a mechanic, and he had to give it a name.
Yeah, and that's the rule. That's the name he picked for it. Name it 50 different other things. It doesn't matter. That's what...
Well, at one point, and I think I took this bit out, at one point, the keyword system said keywords have like a canonical name. Which is like their machine code name, but you're allowed to name them anything you like as the player, as long as it's not one of the other reserved machine code names. So you've got something called Bloodthirsty, which means if you eliminate a unit, you get some, you heal some damage essentially. And like, if you're a vampire, that's totally like, yeah, it's the red thirst, like cool. Or if I'm like ghouls and I'm eating them, like amazing, or trolls or something. But equally, it could be like, you know, it could be any number of things. And none of those are bloodthirsty necessarily. Like, you know, if you're like well-trained and you get to like a point in the battlefield and you eliminate the enemy and like the trumpet goes and you're like, yes, okay, we're absolutely rigorous. And it's like, it's an expression of your like, your grit and determination. And, you know, that rule would have a different name. It wouldn't be called bloodthirsty, but it would be functionally identical. But obviously that's ludicrous. You can't allow everyone to just make up the names of rules all day long, but.
No, absolutely. And to me, it's really interesting, like, that you have a certain position about miniatures and you've made, like, Pacific Command that doesn't have miniatures in it, and you've made Hobgoblin that lets you bring your miniatures but doesn't care about what miniatures you use. It wants you to have fun with them, but it doesn't put any weight on it one way or another, or name things, or, yeah, chariot can be an angel, can be a, you know, monster, whatever it can be. And because that's your like particular perspective of like the minis are assumed, now let's have some fun with them.
You've gone to
this place where you've got this thing, but because I assume you love miniatures, this doesn't care about them in a really weird sort of meta, like almost modern art way. At some point, Hobgoblin is like super old school, but super like bizarrely hyper meta as a game, depending on how you look at it. It's just,
yeah,
it's an interesting thing. And if you think that is an interesting thing, if you like the idea of diegesis in a game, if you enjoy non-diegetic moments, if you've had a game that's really had its theme and genre and play really meshed together, you know, tell us about it in the comments section. If when they mesh together, that upsets you because it constrains you in the other part of the game that you want to enjoy, tell us about that in the comments section as well. If you're telling us about things in the comments section, do hit the like and subscribe buttons. And then look at the links that are down there just above the comments, but below this. And in there, there's a link to the Discord. Follow through, chat to us in there. And also there's a link to Mike's Patreon. Swing past there, give him money, and he will continue to enjoy his metaverse of creativity, and you will feel happy, and you will be bought into that metaverse also. The Mike Gamick universe, the MGU. For now, from this episode, the Rule of Carnage, it's going to be a thank you and goodbye. So thank you and goodbye.
Yeah, bye. Thanks, bye.